Caregivers, have you ever felt like nothing? I mean, nothing is going right? Well, cheer up and welcome to Dave the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Program, where you'll learn how to avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout and how to survive the grief process. You know, with roughly 100 million caregivers in the U.S. and Canada alone, that's about a third of the population. That means that everyone probably knows someone caring for a loved one. Join Dave and his guests now and every Wednesday at noon Pacific time as they discuss avoiding caregiver burnout and surviving grief. So find a comfortable place to relax, kick up your feet, and prepare to feel better and to receive practical tips and tools that you can start using immediately to get you through today and every day so you can survive your tomorrows. But not just survive, but to live life fully and abundantly. Yes, you heard me right. That is a possible goal to achieve. And now, here's your host, Dave Nassani. Los Angeles, a big LA welcome to all my listeners out there in Radio Land. I am Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver, coming to you live globally through the famous Blog Talk Radio Network. Yes, folks, I am the guy who's going to help you and guide you through this very difficult journey called caregiving. And we're going to do our very best to help you avoid that dreaded thing called caregiver burnout. I know it sounds nasty. It is. But we have an exciting show planned for you today. I can't wait. And my lovely co-host, Adrian Gruberg, is here, founder of the Caregiver Space. And today we will be interviewing author and caregiver Douglas Cooper with one of the most amazing stories I have ever heard in my entire life. Next to my story, of course. No, I'm just kidding. So stay tuned. You will not want to miss this show. And if you're new to the show, we get many new listeners every week, especially since we've gone to video. I am your host, Dave Nassani, and this show is to caregivers of every kind. And the one thing we know about caregivers, right? I'll tell you a little secret. They're caring, they're selfless, they're sacrificial, and oh yeah, here's the bad part. They are very prone to burnout because they tend to put everyone else's needs above their own. You know how it is. They give and they give and they give and they give and they give until there's nothing left to give, and then they get sicker than the person they're caring for. You know, just follow the advice the airlines give us. It says, in the event of an emergency, put your own oxygen mask on first before you help your loved one with their mask. And the airlines know this so well because if you don't put your needs above your loved ones, you will most likely black out and you won't be any good to anybody with anything. Now, you don't want that, do you? No. Hey, we also talk about grief and loss here and the devastating effects that it can have on us. It throws us into this other thing called the grief process. Ouch. Wow. Unfortunately, folks, only one way out of the grief process. You got to go through it. Can't go around it, over it, under it. No shortcuts. Got to go through it. And hopefully we can help you through your grief and your loss if you happen to feel like, you know, you're kind of stuck. Everyone does that every once in a while. Hey, let me take this time to thank my last week's guest, Dr. Larry T. Force, a licensed clinical social worker and a National Board Certified Clinical Hypnotherapist. It was a great show, and you can hear that show on my website, caregivers, caregiver.com. That's caregivers with an S, caregiver without an S, because I'm Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver. And just a reminder, when you're there, don't forget to check out our quiz. Are you a candidate for burnout? It's a short quiz. And if you take it, I'm going to do a very nice thing for you. I'm going to send you a copy of my first book absolutely free. One arm, one leg, 100 words, overcoming unbelievable hardships, getting rave reviews. I think here it is right there. Absolutely free. All right, enough of that. Douglas, welcome to the show, and thank you so much for agreeing to this interview today. I really appreciate it. And Adrian, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Doug, why don't you take a minute or two and introduce yourself. Just who is Douglas Winslow Cooper? That's quite a name, isn't it?
That's a nice name, isn't it?
Yeah, I wish I had that name.
Yeah.
You sound like name. Royalty in the royal family or something.
It took Douglas W. Cooper and expanded it nicely. There were enough other Douglas W. Coopers that I wanted to be distinctive when I wrote my books.
And
my
first book, Winslow, you're the only one who I know with that name. So that's an honor.
There was a Governor Winslow on the Mayflower. I don't know how closely we're related, but we'll take it, right?
Absolutely.
Anyway, my story starts in Manhattan in 1942. Wow. Where I was born, and I was born and nearly died. It turns out I had something called water on the brain, hydrocephalus. Mm. And my mother prayed and said I would be a good person. And one way or another, I was cured. And
wow.
I went 65 years without having this recur. And 8 years ago, it came back. And eventually, I got an operation that put a tube in the middle of my brain and ran it down into my abdomen. And I'm doing just fine. But the most important part of my story is a half century love affair with Tina Sue. Mm. Not S-U-E, but S-U-E. Sue was born Sue Ting Ting in Kunming, China in 1944.
Wow.
Her father was a chemical engineer, a Chinese man who got his doctorate from MIT because he got to MIT on a nationwide Chinese scholarship related to money from the Boxer Rebellion. It was World War II. They were in Western China. He was helping the Allies with a gasohol factory, and they were putting money aside for him and his wife in case someday they wanted to visit the United States of America. The war got over.
Let me interrupt. Pop her picture up there. You have a beautiful picture of her.
Lovely woman. She's a beautiful woman.
We like to show off our good-looking wives.
Well, you know, we'd like to say.
Higher.
We were beyond.
There you go.
She's beautiful.
Beautiful woman.
Isn't she lovely? Yes.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's even easier to love a beautiful woman.
There was an old song in the 60s. If you want to have a wonderful life, pick an ugly girl to marry you. Hey, baby, I saw your wife the other day, and boy, was she ugly.
Yeah, but she can cook.
And no other guys will try to steal her away.
It's too bad, and I like to say that I married above myself.
And of course, so did I.
You've got a good-looking lady there. In any event, I grew up in Manhattan, then went to a small town in upstate New York, got my graduated from there, applied to various schools, and went to Cornell on a Regents scholarship. And my third year at Cornell, I was in a Chinese class. I was a physics major. I had taken French, I had taken Latin, and I thought Chinese would be interesting. And midway through the year, a young woman comes into the class who simply knocked me out. And that was Tina Sue, S-U. And I fell in love with her almost instantly. We marked the date as Valentine's Day, 1963. And from that day on, we went whenever we could, hand in hand, all through Cornell. She went home for the summer. She came back, and my senior year again, it was Doug and Tina all the time. Well, unfortunately, as enthusiastic as we were about each other, very much in love, the parents had another idea. Both sets of parents thought that an interracial marriage would be a bad idea. Her parents, especially being Chinese, were dead set against it. My parents thought that it was risking things. An interracial marriage had more pressure on it than a normal marriage. And marriage is tough enough, as anybody can tell, and as the statistics indicate. We had a tearful parting when I graduated. And I said, if neither of us has married in 5 years, let's marry. And Tina said yes, but didn't believe I meant it. She went off from Cornell to Harvard, got her master's and could have gone on for her doctoral degree. But she married the ideal man from her parents' point of view, a tall Chinese professional biochemist, took her to Chicago where he was on the faculty at the university there, and proceeded to spend the next 16 or 17 years putting her under his thumb. This was a Chinese man who was marrying what he thought was a Chinese woman. Tina was an American woman with a Chinese flavor. And unfortunately, that marriage did not work out. Meanwhile, I graduated from Cornell, took my chances with the draft, got drafted, became a train killer in basic training, went on to Army biological warfare and defense labs in Fort Detrick, Maryland, spent a couple of years there, learning about microbes in the air that could kill you. We used to date the girls from Hood College, and we'd tell them if they weren't cooperative, we'd cough on them. And they'd need a security clearance to get treated. In any event, I went from there to Penn State, got a master's in physics, went on to get a doctorate from Harvard, and went into the field of air pollution and environmental sciences. Meanwhile, at Penn State, I had met the daughter of the richest family in State College, Pennsylvania. I didn't know it at first, but she was a slender, round-faced, dark-haired, intelligent, Caucasian woman who reminded me so much of Tina that I thought she was the second coming of Tina.
You always had Tina on the mind. You never forgot about her, or
I never forgot Tina. I was always in love with Tina, but I thought Carol was the second coming. I thought I really had lucked out, and we
did
had.
Did you know that Tina was married at this time?
Yes. Okay. By that time, I knew she was married. When I was in the Army, to go back up a little bit, she wrote me a letter saying that she was getting married, and I cried. I cried. I thought it was
good. Adrian, isn't this like the greatest love story you've ever heard? I mean, Hollywood should make a movie out of
this. Yeah, it's good.
You can't make this stuff up.
Never forgot. And as you'll hear as we go along, she never forgot me. So I went, I graduated. I spent a couple of years in the Boston area working. And then I became on the faculty of Harvard School of Public Health. And one afternoon, I got a call from a marriage counselor, and somebody that we had
marriage counselor,
my wife and I had used. And he said, Carol needs for us to talk on the phone. And I said, well, why is that? We had talked with this man a few years before because we had some small problems with our marriage that seemed to have been cured. And he said, she's just broken up her affair with a flying instructor, and she's very upset. And I said, she's got a bigger problem than that, because I'm not going to put up with that. I said, I'm not. She may think that I'm going to put up with it, but I'm not. The essence was she was the daughter of very rich parents. We began to get money fairly quickly, and we would have been worth tens of millions. And I guess she assumed that I would stay married to her in order to be part of that. We spent four marriage counseling sessions. We took the Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory, 500 pages of would you rather step on the flag or throw your mother's apple
pie? I've taken that. That's a trip. Yeah.
It's incredible, right? Would you rather step on the flag or throw your mother's apple pie out the window? In any event, we got the results back, and he said to her, I want you to come back twice a week. And he said to me, would you be being in the normal control group for my next study? And I said, vindication. it took a couple of years to get divorced because, as I said, I was not going to put up with it.
And then were you still thinking of Ting?
Yes. When the separation occurred, I wrote to her, and I wrote her a letter that was that her husband could read. You know, how are you? I keep in touch with you. Tell you that my wife and I have separated. I hope everything's going okay. Well, she wrote back to me and said that she's fine. She said everything's okay. She's still married, and her child brings her great joy. And I said to myself, her child brings her great joy, but her husband doesn't bring her great joy.
How did you know that?
Because that's all she said, because the Chinese are such that what is left out is as significant as what is in there. So she said.
That went over my head.
Well, we understood. Tina and I were like this, right? So I dated, I got engaged, I got disengaged. A couple of years after this letter, I was on my way through Chicago on business. I called her and I said, this may be a strange call, but I've never forgotten you. I'm still very much in love with you. I don't know whether anything can happen in the future, but I just had to tell you that. And she said to me, nothing has changed for me in 20 years. And it took us right back to the middle of when we were going with each other. Mm-hmm. And I came home, I was walking on air. I was absolutely delighted. We corresponded pretty quickly. She told me that she had multiple sclerosis. I looked it up and I read about it, and I read that some significant fraction would be quadriplegic on a ventilator, fed with tubes, the whole routine, which is what we have now, although that might be 10% of them or something like that. I called her up the next day and said, will you marry me? And she said, yes.
But
yes,
she's still married at this point?
Still married at that point. Okay. She had to work it out with her husband, with a marriage counselor. It took us another year. Eventually, she came first to her parents with the younger son, and then she came to live with my mother and my sister, and then we got married June 2nd, 1984, and it was the best day of my life.
How old was she, and did her parents approve?
Right. She was 40. I was 41. Her parents, her father said, brilliant man that he was, he toasted us and he said, love conquered all. And I said to myself, as one of those who was conquered, you know it. So one of the things I did, because I couldn't support that situation on the money that I would have gotten as a Harvard associate professor, I had gone to work for IBM at the research center. She came when we got married, she lived with me. We moved shortly thereafter to a larger area. But one of the things I did early was I got long-term care insurance for herself and myself. After 10 years at IBM, she had negligible symptoms, but that was no guarantee that she wouldn't have symptoms. She had a little trouble with walking, and she had some trouble driving the car that led to the confiscation of the keys. That's another story, a difficult one. But in any event, IBM said, if you're 50 or older, and if you've been with us for 10 years or more, have we got a deal for you? And I said to myself, I'm 50, I've been with them for 10 years, and this year they entice you to leave, and probably next year they will push you out. I said, I'll take the deal. It involved, they gave me some money for how long I worked for them, but the most important thing was continued IBM insurance. Cool. And IBM then had 10 years of paraplegia, where I had weekday help from the home health aides while I was still working. Then when our son, younger son, graduated from high school, we moved to a less expensive place. And I then still had weekday help taking care of Tina. And then suddenly she nearly died. She had what's called an aspiration pneumonia, critical care unit of the hospital. When she came to see them, they asked her if she was willing to have them have invasive procedures. And she said, no, you know, I don't want that. I was 15 or 20 minutes after her because I had to close things down at the house. And when I got there, I said, I have her power of attorney, and you do everything that you can to save her life. And they put her in a therapeutic coma. She was there for a week or more in the coma. They got her out of the coma. She then spent another week or two or three where she couldn't talk. We'd make sign language, lip reading, do the letters on the board, the whole business. And when finally she could talk, I said, I'm sorry, but I went against what you told them. I said that they should do everything that they could to save your life. Did I do the right thing? And she said, yes, I want to live. I want to live for you, for the children, and for myself. And later on,
did she have a living will that said she did not want to be resuscitated?
No, she did not have a living will.
Right. Okay.
They might have taken her word for it when she
did
got
she
there.
Discuss with you what she wanted beforehand?
No.
Okay.
We just
never had the discussion.
No.
The right thing. You did what you felt you needed to do.
I just knew that she loved me and I loved her, and that we would want that to last as long as we could. After 100 days in the critical care unit, she was starting to pick up infections from the other inhabitants. Yeah. And they said, well, it's home hospice. They gave her only a few months to live because her immune system was impaired. I said, it's home. I asked her, well, we decided it's home. And we've done 12 years of round-the-clock nursing on a ventilator, quadriplegic, fed through a gastric tube. And it's been an extraordinarily valuable experience, despite the fact that she has lost so much.
And how is life for her? I mean, is she having quality of life? It doesn't sound good, but maybe I don't know.
Right. The first 10 years were excellent. The next 10 years were good. The paraplegic years were good. We go to the son's sports games. We could do almost anything that we could do. The quadriplegic years, except for the last couple of years, were also good. The last couple of years, she's had trouble with communication. And as you know, Dave, that's another tremendous loss. So she's had trouble with her speech. And yet, we get her up every afternoon. I'll ask her how she's doing. I see her frequently in bed. But when I get her up, I'll ask her how she's doing. Often it's not too well, but usually after she's been up for a while, how are you doing? Much better. And her reports are generally favorable, and the nurses tell me generally she's in good spirits because she's next in a room next to mine practically. I see her every few hours and check on her. So the last couple of years have been tough, and even so, life is precious. And even in this situation, I think when people talk about quality of life, you can't predict how you're going to feel about it until you get there. Okay. Right. When you're in the midst of it, you're not in a great situation to evaluate it. And only after you've passed through something do you know essentially how you feel about it.
We're going to take a break. So thank you for bringing us up to this. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about some of the beautiful things that have happened in your lives. So don't go away.
One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships is about Charlene, a stroke survivor. Back in 1996, Charlene was a healthy, normal, very active 52-year-old woman whose amazing talents resemble that of both a Martha Stewart and a Wonder Woman. But all that changed when she suffered a massive stroke that left her severely speech impaired and paralyzed on the right side. Who am I? My name is David. I've had the privilege of being Charlene's husband since 1975. We had a wonderful, fairy tale, storybook-like courtship that culminated in our marriage a year later. Charlene had just come out of a marriage where after 10 years, she received two black eyes and a broken nose by her former husband when he came home high on speed. Charlene believed in no second chances of any kind for abuse, so she left. Finding herself all alone in the world with her 5 and 10-year-old daughters, Cynthia Lorraine and Deborah Lynn, she started raising them by herself for the next 2 years. Then fate brought us all together. After falling in love with Charlene, Cindy, and Debbie, our love then produced Rebecca Elizabeth. We had a wonderful, normal life for the next 20 years. But today, things are very different for everyone. One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships is the amazing story of a woman's fight to survive all that life had thrown her way. Everyone who knows Charlene is thoroughly amazed at how she lives day by day, month by month, year by year, and with a smile on her face and hope in her heart that everything is going to be okay. Her faith in God is her foundation in this hope, that everything happens for a reason, and what doesn't kill her will make her stronger. She inspires everyone who meets her. Her accomplishments since her stroke are very impressive, often making us normal people look like whiners and complainers. So pick up your copy of One Arm, One Leg, 100 Words, Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships today. You won't be disappointed. Just hear what best-selling author Lynn Barrington has to say about it. If you think you have it bad, read this book. This is a beautiful, genuine story told from the heart. It's inspiring and easy to read. When you finish this book, you'll be able to look at your concerns in a new light. How about the reaction of 9-time Grammy and Dove Award recipient, the godfather of contemporary gospel Christian music, Andre Crouch? Charlene just won't let the promises of God go, and she has not let her circumstances get in the way of her faith. She's not just a survivor, she's more than a conqueror, as the Bible states. You'll be encouraged by her testimony, regardless of what you're going through. Available everywhere, but if you purchase your copy directly from the author's website, onearmoneleg100words.com, Charlene and David will personally autograph your copy. Enjoy!
And we're back with Douglas Cooper. All right. Well, that's an amazing story you've shared so far, Douglas. I want to mention how blessed she is to have you, Douglas, because I don't know what her first husband was like. But Adrian, you and I both know we've heard more stories than we want to hear about when someone enters into a disability, the other spouse. Sometimes very quickly, while they're even in the hospital, file for divorce or leave them and say, you know, I didn't sign up for this. I'm out of here.
Especially the husbands.
Especially the husbands, but not always the husbands, but especially the husbands.
Not always, but.
Yeah. So I don't know this man, but, you know, there's probably a good chance that maybe he wouldn't have stuck around. Maybe he would have. I don't know.
Well, he was very, very much involved with his work, excessively so. So yeah. It's hard to know how that would have gone. Now, we did meet a couple. We were in our 50s and they were in our 40s. And he was a PhD chemist. And she was a very, very bright, very nice Japanese-American woman who had Parkinson's. And we had them over for lunch. And I thought that we didn't eat them. We gave them lunch. And I thought they would reciprocate and have us back. But as a matter of fact, I learned that only a few months later, he left her. So in fact, this is not too often the case. But the thing about it is, I feel that I was given the opportunity to marry the person that I love. This is a person that I'm so lucky to have. To have somebody worthy of your devotion is an extraordinarily good feeling. And so if you can be devoted to somebody who is worthy of it, it's very, very enriching. So my feeling is that these last couple of years, in a sense, have been particularly difficult because of the communication loss. And yet it's part of the payment for the wonderful opportunity for the 30 years we had before that, and to some degree, even for the years we're having now. I still love her very, very much.
So what a wonderful love story. You know, love is not dead, you know, and you bring back faith in mankind and the ability to get along with people. You know, it's just amazing. I wish there were more people like you.
The themes of Ting and I are the power of love, the importance of marriage, and the value of life, even very disabled life.
Yeah, the power of love. Love is very, very powerful. I mean, think in history, you know, nations have been conquered over love. People have been murdered over love. I mean, so many things are done in the name of love. Wow, you think of Cleopatra and Mark Antony. Look what they gave up for their love, you know, Romeo and Juliet. Anyway, so let's talk about your book and how you have chronicled and exemplified your love for the world to understand. Now, you wrote a book of songs, and there were a couple in there that I wanted you to read or sing, whatever you prefer.
Actually, the short story that I sent you was based on a song that was written by somebody else. The book itself, Ting and I, is a memoir rather than a book.
Share some of that.
Okay. Well, the song is, you were meant for me, and I was meant for you. Nature patterned you, and when she was done, you were all the sweet things. Rolled up in one, you're like a plaintive melody that never, ever, never, ever lets me free. And I'm content. The angels must have sent you, and they meant you just for me. I wish I could sing, but anyway, the idea is we sometimes say we were fated to be mated. And it's hard to know. I know you have a belief that God guides people's paths very firmly. I think more we're in God's casino. We come in with certain chips. We play our hands the best we can. If we pray, maybe God inspires us and we play a little bit, play our hand a little better than we would otherwise. But there's so many things that happen that are outside our control. And I don't think God controls our path, but that's a theological discussion for another day. In any event, I feel very fortunate to be able to be in love and married to Tina Sue.
I'm curious about what was going through your head, you know, the debate. I know I went through a time, you know, as a young man, 21 years old, marrying an older woman, 10 years older than me, with a crazy ex-husband who's been known to slash tires of the people she was dating, and two children from a previous marriage. And, you know, no one in my family thought I was making a good decision. I was still in college. Yeah. And so I heard a lot of, what are you thinking? But, you know, we were in love. And fortunately, in my case, it worked out. Now, what was going through your head when she told you that she had multiple sclerosis and you knew that possibly she would be a quadriplegic, possibly a ventilator, possibly receiving round-the-clock nursing at home? What was the debate that was going on in your mind, or was there a debate?
Oh, I didn't sleep that night, and I cried a lot. And I thought to myself, well, look, Doug, you're essentially breaking up a marriage, even though I knew that it was an unhappy marriage. And she revealed that she had given some thought to divorce, but she wasn't divorced and she hadn't started down that way. I said, you're breaking up a marriage, okay? And you're taking on a situation where the long-term problems may be great. On the other hand, you don't want her to go through that without you. And you don't want her to go through that without you. And that really was the essence of it. I said, I want to do this. I'll do it with her. I'll do whatever it takes to be with her and to make it a little bit better for her. And lately, when people have asked, what are we doing? To some degree, we are helping Tina have a soft landing. Because, you know,
there's a movie out, The Princess Bride. I don't know if you ever saw it. But, you know, they talk about true love, you know. And she had this dream that she was going to marry, you know, the evil guy, and this wretched person says, shame on you. You know, how dare you? You know, true love was given to you and you spit on it, you know. And this is true love. I mean, his main reason for marrying her was that he didn't want her to go through that with somebody who maybe didn't love her. Wow.
I mean, really appeared in my eye. The fact that the three of us that are on right now are all people who were very much in love with the people that they're with. I've lost my husband already, Douglas, but it's wonderful to know. I mean, things that many people wouldn't have done, that I did, that you've done, that Dave has done. I mean, it's remarkable. And I consider people who are on the receiving end of care from people like us to be extraordinary, because they know how the love is so important to them. And even if at times they feel that they're a burden, the love is still there. And they know that in their core, they know the love is still there. And it's so beautiful.
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, you know, I'm here, Adrian is here, to make sure people don't burn out, that they don't give and give and give, like you heard in my introduction, and there's nothing left to give. How do you, you know, stay grounded, stay balanced? Yes, you love her. Yes, you'd give your life for her. But do you put your needs above hers?
Yes, I would say
so. As a caregiver?
Yeah, I would say Tina is very important to me. Certainly, I've made lots of choices in my life that put her first, but I know basically I've got to keep myself healthy, strong, you know, in good spirits, not let things get me down. So indeed, like putting the face mask on before you put it on the child. Yes, I do try to take care of myself. When I go to the doctor, I and I go frequently for checkups, one thing and another. I said, I feel it like a pregnant woman. We're doing this for two people.
Exactly.
For Tina. Tina needs my care, and I need Tina. So that's the way I feel about it. So I do take care of myself. When I wrote the book, we've told our story many times, mm-hmm. and people had said they want to write a book about your love story. And I said, thank you very much. Well, Tina was lying in bed 5 years ago and quadriplegic on a ventilator doing her Christopher Reeve thing. And she said, are you going to write the book? I said, what? She said, are you going to write our book about us? I said, do you want me to write the book? She said, yes, mm-hmm. I want you to write. So that was in March of 2011. And a few months later, I had written the book.
Wow.
And one of the things I did with the book, I told her story. I told my story. I philosophized because I'm a theorist. And then I had the nurses and friends and family write something about Tina. So the last 20% of Ting and I are tributes from family, friends, and nurses. And it really is, what can I say? I think it's extraordinary. Ting and I.
So how quickly did you learn this thing about putting your needs first? I mean, did you not do it and then you burned out and then you discovered that you need to do it? I mean, what process did you go through?
I'm a very rational person, and I realized all along that this was going to be a marathon, not a sprint. And therefore, and therefore I had to take care of myself and take care of Tina. And there is a guilt problem there because you don't know where to draw the line when you've worried too much about your own self and not enough about your partner. And you just sort of have to decide what seems to be about enough and what is it that you need to be doing in order to be able to continue doing what you're doing.
Well, I think you must know that the guilt feeling is something that a lot of caregivers experience. That's a normal thing. But you're in a very fortunate position of being able to have round-the-clock care.
Right.
There are so many people who can't do that.
Exactly.
And they have to take care of themselves too, but I'm very glad that you're in the position that you are in. You're smart enough to get long-term care a long time ago.
Yeah, and we encourage everybody to do that while you're, you know, in your 40s or 50s before you need
40s,
it.
40s, even cheap 30s.
Thinking about our interview, Dave and Adrian, I was thinking about one of the themes that we ought to push is responsibility, and responsibility for yourself as well as responsibility for the person that you're caring for. And one of the things I think is, look, take care of yourself, because you're either going to be a caregiver or somebody's going to be taking care of you.
I know.
Absolutely.
It's almost one of those two things. And if you're not careful, you're going to have an accident. You're going to take the wrong kind of drugs. You're going to do things that shorten your life. You're going to smoke. You're going to drink excessively. You're going to do things that are going to make you end up having to be cared for. Now, in your case and in my case, there was nothing that Tina or Charlene could have done that would have changed the probability that somebody would have to take care of them. But for all of us, the first thing you want to do is use your head. Be prudent, okay? Live as long as you can, as well as you can.
As well as you can.
After that, if you're going to get married, know that married is not just being madly in love. That's God's little trick. We fall madly in love, and then we figure out.
Sickness and in health, yeah.
And sickness and in health, to death do you part, exactly. And if you decide you're going to get married, recognize that there's a damn good chance that one or the other of you is going to be taking care of that person for a significant period of time.
Absolutely.
Tell us more about the book, Ting and I, A Memoir of Love, Courage, and Devotion.
Okay. It starts with the decision of home or the hospice. And as we talked a little bit about quality of life, it's very hard to predict what the quality of life will be. Tina, at this point, when we made that decision, was quadriplegic on a ventilator, getting round the clock nursing care, and that's what she didn't have to have at home. And the question was whether or not she could still have a life that she could enjoy. And we have had 12 rather good years. I remember a couple of years ago, after 10 years of this, we were sitting out on our porch, and I said, well, how do you feel? What if we were to die tomorrow, would it have been worth it? And she said, absolutely. And I said, yes, I feel the same way. So, I mean, I think that is the summation of it, despite the fact that she seems to be so limited in what she could do. It's life is precious and can be precious.
Yeah, you know, you're making me, one second, Adrian, don't lose that thought. You're making me think of my my own living will, which I made. I says, you know, I don't want to be on a ventilator. I don't want any tubes. Blah, blah, blah. I mean, if it was me, they would have pulled the plug on me.
You don't know. You don't know. You have no idea. And I think to myself, well, what if I were in this situation? And now I know. I've seen how Tina has handled it. I've seen heroism, but I've also seen that she enjoys things. She enjoys her family. She enjoys her television. She enjoys music.
There's still things.
She is an exceptional person, but I think we quickly view people who are handicapped, and we don't understand the quality of life that they still can achieve. Okay? And in fact, one of my co-authors and I are going to work on a book called Apparently Different. And it's about people who seem to be in such a different situation, but who want to be treated pretty much as we all want to be treated, and hope to have pretty much what we all hope to have.
Yeah. Adrian?
That's interesting. I wanted to know what kind of things you were able to do together. You mentioned music. I don't. Do you go out to the movies? Any theater? Any? Do you do anything where she's in a wheelchair and you take her someplace, or is it pretty much at home?
Before, during the first 10 years, of course, we did everything together. So that during the next 10 years, when she was paraplegic, we had a handicapped van and we would go places the way most people would, but we would find that we had fewer friends, fewer acquaintances. People sort of separated themselves from us, partly because we couldn't easily do reciprocal dinners, we couldn't do reciprocal favors, partly because people are afraid that you might ask them for help.
That's right.
I wish it weren't true, but people are worried that you're going to be a burden on them. So we were able to do pretty much all of those things that we wanted to do, and I would get Tina up for each meal. Okay, and we would interact that way. We would go to Phil's basketball, my youngest son's basketball game, stuff like that. So that was fairly normal. By the time we got to quadriplegic and round-the-clock nursing, now there was less and less that we could do. There were a period of physical intimacy, but that eventually was brought to a halt, unfortunately. I still would get Tina up every afternoon, and we would essentially watch whatever she wanted to watch. Now, that's an interesting point. She was a brilliant woman. She's not that anymore. She's still intelligent, but she is not. This was a woman who was tops in her high school class, has a bachelor's with honors from Cornell, has a master's with honors from Harvard, who was intellectual equal of anybody that you could imagine. No longer that, but she still enjoys certain things. So when she gets up, we watch Home and Garden TV together, and we watch it in the kitchen. Okay. And when the weather's decent, I take her out for a half mile, all in a stroll, out and about on the ground. We live on one side of us a golf course, on the other side of us is a 20-acre lake, and we call it our year-round vacation home. And that's one of the reasons we bought it. And so when the weather's decent, we go out for that half hour stroll. We come back, I do her teeth, we watch a little TV. And then during the day, I pop in, make sure she's getting good care, which she always gets. And I'll tell her that I'm still madly in love with her. I'll ask her, what's her number? She'll say one, I'll say, you're number one, tippy top ting. So what we have is that kind of interaction. It's not what we want. It's not not what anybody might imagine would be enough, but it's better than nothing, okay? And it's precious. As I like to say, the glass is half full, but what's left is still precious.
You know, what you were talking about of friends, that's how you know if you have true friends or just, you know, acquaintances, because acquaintances won't hang around.
No, you know? Friendly acquaintances don't hang around. Yeah.
But they act like friends until something happens, you know.
That's right. That's right. Now, the litmus test.
I also want to ask you about her parents. Do they stay in touch? They're still living in China? Are they out here? Or how often do they visit?
Okay, well, we'll get back to the story. The family left China in 1946, right after World War II. He went on to become assistant associate and full professor, University of Rochester, New York. Her elder sister went to Cornell and then eventually became an orthodontist. Tina went to Cornell and eventually became an Asian studies specialist. While she was married to her first husband, she worked on the editorial board of the Encyclopedia Britannica. The younger son went on. This is quite a family. The younger son went on to Brown and became a doctor. But the parents died in the 1980s and 1990s. Okay? So the nice thing was they were very supportive after having been opposed to this marriage. They realized the logic of having somebody who loved Tina the way I love Tina.
How about the siblings? Do they come by?
Once a year, whether they need to or not. I don't want to be too tough on them.
Was she to them before all this happened?
Close to the younger brother. He lives in Michigan. Not so close to the older sister. She lives. So you know, we understand the separation is difficult. They are very generous. They've given us nice gifts from time to time, and they wish us well. But finally, I'm the person who's responsible for Tina. Nobody else.
So let's talk about you, since this is a caregiver show. What do you do in your spare time when you're not caring for her?
I retired early at 58 when our younger son graduated. We moved to this year-round country home. And for the first 10 years, I was, as I said, profoundly retired. Instead of profoundly retired, I was profoundly retired. Oh, I did a little internet. I took naps. I walked the dog around the lake. I managed the nursing. I kept track of things. I billed IBM for the expense because we pay the nurses and IBM pays us. So I did a certain amount of that. I probably put in 10 or 15 hours a week of part-time management of the nursing situation. But then, as I said, when Tina asked me to write the book, I then got involved in this hobby business of writing books and helping people write and publish their books. And that's been kind of fun. It hasn't taken off. I've got an internet site. I've done Facebook. I've done Twitter. I've done LinkedIn. I've done all the things they say you should do. And a partial success, but not a big deal. So that's what I'm doing. And there was some hope that I would be teaching this spring. I gave a talk on caregiving at a local college, and the fellow Larry Force asked me if I'd be interested in being an adjunct professor. I said, adjunct faculty member, drop professor. I said, that might be interesting. What would we talk? What would I do? Well, I finally went to the college website, and I saw they needed a math teacher, fairly elementary math teacher, pre-calculus. Well, this is something I could do. I've got a doctorate in engineering from Harvard. I had quite a bit of math, as you might imagine. And so I volunteered to do this. Well, the first thing we heard from the chairman of the math department was the woman who's the vice president for academic affairs, concerned about the quality of the adjunct program. I said, that's fine. I said, here's the resume. Here is a list of my 140 peer-reviewed publications. No, want some more than that? Okay, here are my, they asked for my transcripts, Cornell honors, Penn State near the very top, Harvard near the middle. They got that. Then the next thing I hear is, well, the vice president for academic affairs is afraid you might teach above the level of the students. I said to the chairman of the department, there's something else going on here. I don't know what it is. It may be that I'm too white, too male, too old, or too good looking, but there's something that isn't right. So I was very excited about teaching, and I went through a period of depression, not terrible, a disappointment, a period of disappointment. And now I'm back to my joking self, which comes from the saying, the world is a comedy to those who think and a tragedy to those who feel. And I try to be on the thinking side.
Wow.
Would you be open to working with people in, let's say, the palliative care unit at hospitals, teaching caregivers when their family members are discharged, what caregiving is all about?
I explored that. I have a business coach who has looked into that a bit for me, and we might end up doing that. Sure, to tell people what it's like, because the next book, and I'm so glad you asked, is called How to Manage Nursing Care at Home.
Excellent.
And we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that right after our break, so don't go away.
Anytime we suffer loss, we grieve. And a lot of people don't realize what even the grief process is. But it could be 5 to 7 steps, ranging from denial, I don't believe this is happening, anger, oh my gosh, I'm so upset this is happening, to a form of bargaining, how can I get out of this, to depression, which is a very serious thing because that often leads to suicide. And then finally, after you realize you have no more control over your situation and you're totally okay with the new normal that it brings, that wonderful, wonderful place called acceptance.
Being a caregiver takes a special person with passion and compassion. But even you can become a little burned out from time to time. The Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Show was developed to help you overcome obstacles, adversity, and burnout, as well as just having a place to rest, relax, and recharge your batteries. We've all been there, and you're not alone. Now, you can take the Caregiver's Caregiver with you. Get the top 25 radio shows in convenient form that plugs right into your USB car stereo or computer. Learn the techniques, tips, and encouragement we all need to better handle the day-to-day challenges. For around $1 per show, just $29.77, get the credit card-sized USB card to have with you anytime you need a caregiver's pick-me-up. Just go to DaveTheCaregiversCaregiver.com and order yours today. Go to DaveTheCaregiversCaregiver.com now. Consider it an investment in you and ultimately an investment in them.
And we're back with Douglas Cooper and Adrian Gruberg. All right, let's continue that conversation we were having about your new book, yet to be published.
We just sent the manuscript in to Outskirts Press yesterday. My head nurse, Diane Bagan, and I, and the book is called How to Manage Nursing Care at Home, subtitle, Deciding on, Preparing for, and Managing Home Care. And it's 275 pages of distilled wisdom.
Did you self-publish, or is it a publisher?
It's essentially self-published. It's published by Outskirts, they will publish almost anything. So then you take your chances on whether the public likes it.
Think that's a much-needed book.
Absolutely. I hope so. We start out with the questions that the journalists ask: who, what, when, where, why, and how. Okay. And then we go into discussing some of the major biological systems and what the treatments are, so people understand what the nurses are doing there. And finally, at the end, I've got several appendices on caregivers. One of them is 5 tips for empowered caregivers. Another is acts of kindness toward caregivers. Another is the Successful Caregiver's Guide. So we do include caregivers from beginning to end.
Now, frequently, Doug, we come across people, caregivers, who are doing this at home, and they just don't realize that they have reached the point where they cannot adequately care for this person at home anymore. They need to go in a facility. But for whatever reason, maybe they promised they'd never put them in a facility, or maybe the loved one said, don't you dare put me in a facility or I'll come back and haunt you, or so, whatever the reason is. And you know, with good reason, because 9 out of 10 facilities I wouldn't put my cat in. It takes a lot of hard work to find a really, really good facility. It did with my mother, and we finally did find a good facility, and it was a blessing. So how do you, is there a chapter in your book on when it's time to let go and look for a good facility, how to find a good facility, and that it is okay, if this is killing you, that you must put them in a facility?
Better than that, I recognize I recommend somebody else's book. the book I recommend is by Rick Lauber. It's called The Successful Caregiver's Guide. It's terrific. And he goes through this whole thing. It is for people who have to put somebody they love into a facility, and how to choose and how to manage that whole situation. So if you're going to do it at home, you want our book. If you're going to do it through a care facility, Rick Lauber's The Compassionate Guide. Let me read the title to be sure. The Successful Caregiver's Guide. It's an excellent book, and you might very well consider having Rick Lauber be on one of your programs. If you check it through Amazon, you can. Mm-hmm.
Do you have contact with him?
Yeah. So I can forward a.
That'd be awesome.
Email.
Thank you.
Yeah, very good. So that's pretty good. We have a chapter on the timing, but essentially says there does come a time when perhaps you decide that you have to separate and you have to manage it. The book doesn't go into that. My personal feeling, because of our particular situation, is I plan to go bankrupt before Tina goes to a nursing home.
Well, yeah.
That's
wow. Anything to add, Adrian? What were you going to say?
Yeah, I was.
It looked important.
When did you stop sleeping in the same room? At what point?
Ah, good question.
But was it time to separate that way?
Let's see. When we moved from when Phil graduated and I was 58, and we moved from Ramsey, New Jersey, to our year-round country home, I think I was still sleeping with Tina until she became had the crisis. I think that's right, but I'm not absolutely sure. It was 10, 14 years ago. In any event, when she came back from the hospital, and now we had set up the critical care unit, we were not together except in this way. We were not given financial support for overnight nursing from MVP company. Blue Cross Blue Shield had done it, and eventually we got switched to MVP. So for a year, they would not pay for overnight nursing. So from 10 a.m. at night to 8 in the morning, I slept right in the bed beside Tina, and I would get up and do the things that needed to be done in the middle of the night. When we finally got round-the-clock nursing, after a year, we had to go through several levels of appeal within MVP and also within IBM. They finally took it to an independent group, and they said, of course this is not custodial care, which is what you give a well infant. This is skilled nursing care, and of course you pay for round-the-clock nursing care. So as soon as that happened, we got an overnight nurse, and I was able to get my sleep upstairs.
I have a great question that piggybacks on this. You know, for whatever reason, we know that the minority of men are caregivers, right? Would you say it's about 10%, Adrian, or more than that?
Yeah.
Well, 90% women, 10% men, maybe 80-20, but it's significantly lower than men. You know, you and I are a rarity.
It is a growing number, however.
Yeah.
It is. I knew it was 10 or 20%, but it's changed.
Yeah. So my question, as a man, because I'm I I'm right with you on this. How do you tell men without terrifying them that there may come a time where, you know, the sexual intimate relationship with your spouse, if it's a spouse that you're caring for, you know, might stop? And how do you deal with that? What were some of the things that went through your mind? And just share what you were feeling when that happened.
That's right. It's a loss. It's a real loss. Physically, it's not so much the physical loss for those who are enamored of do-it-yourself projects. It's not so much a physical loss as it is an emotional loss. You don't have the closeness that you once had. And that really, to me, was the bigger loss. Now at 74, none of it matters all that much. But a few years ago, it was a physical loss, but more it was an emotional loss. And yeah. You just look, you didn't have it before you got married, and now you don't have it even though you are married. Move on.
Yeah.
Okay, the more important things.
Love is more than sex.
Yes.
And Adrian, for the women, I think it's probably easier for them, isn't it?
It depends on the woman. It depends on the relationship. You can't just write women off as being non-sexual beings that are just doing it for the hell of it, you know.
Well, that's the stereotype.
Some of us like,
you know,
the, it.
Yeah, the stereotype. Not now I have a headache, you know.
A not man now never I says have a he headache. Had a
The men never have headaches, but women always have headaches.
It's a cliche that shouldn't be applied to everyone.
Yeah,
right. And yet there's truth to it, or it wouldn't have become a cliche.
Well, yeah, exactly. But if we're talking about baby boomers, I mean, yes, things have changed. Maybe you didn't have good sex with your first husband, but you had better sex with your second husband. I'm not a typical person that way, so.
In my relatively small sample of women, I've found a fairly wide range of interest in sex.
Even
older women, I mean, into your 70s, 80s, maybe even 90s. You know, when my mother was in her place, you'd be surprised the affairs or the connections, the romances that were going on with these 80 and 90-year-old women and men.
I would be surprised, David.
Okay, so on that note, we've run out of time. And why don't you two tell us how we can get a hold of both of you and how to buy your books and how to reach your websites and contact you if we want more information?
I'd be happy to correspond with anyone who likes to. It's douglas@tingandi.com. TINDI. As in tingandi.com.
You cut out a little. That's TINGANDI.com.
Okay. TINGANDI.com. In other words, she and I.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's the way it is. And that's the way it'll be forever. Our the headstone on our grave, because we have a family plot now, and it says together forever. And that is our slogan.
Oh, and your book is on Amazon, I assume.
Yes, that's the easiest way to get it, tingandi.com. Tingandi.
Adrian, how can someone get a hold of you?
I will also correspond with anyone. It's Adrian, ADRIENNE, at thecaregiverspace.org. And that's the website is thecaregiverspace.org. And we now have a buddy program. So
how's that working out? Addition.
Very well. And cool. We also have a community page on Facebook now, which is more private than the other page.
I'll have to talk to you about me having one as well. I've been toying with the idea for years, and I just don't know how to do it, but I know you'll help me out. Well, thank you both for coming on the show. Yeah. We really, really appreciate it. And just a reminder, all our live shows become recorded podcasts and videocasts on our website, caregivers.com. That's caregivers with an S, caregiver without an S, www.thebeingacaregiver.com. And they're on YouTube. They're on podcast.com. They're everywhere. And when you are on my site, don't forget to take our short quiz, Are You a Candidate for Burnout, to assess where you are in the burnout process, and to get, of course, your free copy of my first book, One Arm, One Leg, 100words.com. That's shameless plug. Overcoming Unbelievable Hardships. $10 value, absolutely free. Why? Because we're just, that's just who we are. So thank you. And yes, be back next Wednesday at noon every day.
Next
Goodbye.
Wednesday?
Well, yes, we tape it on Tuesdays, but
oh,
we air
okay.
it on Wednesdays.
Okay. Thank you. That's so cool.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining Dave, the Caregiver's Caregiver Radio Show. Make sure you tune in every Wednesday at noon Pacific Time and anytime afterwards on podcast to catch more of Dave and his tips to caregivers on avoiding burnout and surviving the grief process right here on the Worldwide Block Talk Radio Network. Goodbye.